Roguecast is the official podcast of Rogues Gallery Comics and Games. Every week we talk about new comic releases, the latest geek culture news, and whatever movies, TV, and other pop culture is on our radar for the week. I'm Randy.
This is Dave.
I'm Nick.
And now, on with the show. So before we get started this week, I just want to tell people, if you are listening to this early, you might still have time to get in on our signing, our super fast signing that is on Wednesday, which is that Cully Hamner is going to be here to sign the Blue Beetle variant cover he did for the character that he co-created from 12:30 to 1:30. It's a quick signing, just an hour, and he's got to be out here by 1:30. So if this is before 12:30, you should come out for that signing. If it's after 12:30, well, what a great signing that was, guys.
We did really good.
Things seemed to go well. I was surprised by the robot attack.
Yeah, I can't believe Cully picked that fan up over his head and said, "This is my fan." It was weird. It was kind of strange.
And yet, it's exactly what happened.
It's exactly what will have happened. Anyway, you also have one more week to get in on our Book of the Month, Game of the Month, Suicide Squad, Trial by Fire, the John Ostrander book that we all love. Is 15% off, 25% off if you got a rogue card, and Pandemic, if you have a rogue card, is 10% off. These are favorites of ours and worth a look.
I'm not going to say it's the real Suicide Squad, but it's the real Suicide Squad.
But it's the real Suicide Squad. I'll say it. And then we will have new announcements next week for what the new Book of the Month, Game of the Month is for September. Also in September, it is going to be Batman Day. That might give you a hint as to what one of the books might be. Batman Day is shaping up to be pretty cool.
Is it Batman Day the comic book?
It is Batman Day the comic book. Dave's got it. Spoilers. It is Saturday, September 17th. From about noon till 3, we will have Batman and Catwoman here. I've seen both the costumes, and they are awesome. The Batman in particular is sort of the Ben Affleck movie version.
Yeah.
And it's a great looking one. The Catwoman is sort of the classic Darwin Cook.
Oh, nice.
It is a very cool looking, and they're going to be out here. We might have some other guest stars. We don't know for sure, but Batman and Catwoman will be here. You can come take pictures with them, chat with them about cosplay. It should be a lot of fun. We will hopefully have an artist here doing sketches of Batman. Everything Batman will be 15% off, so whether it's the pop vinyls or graphic novels.
Or an Arkham t-shirt.
Or
Batman animated action figures.
Indeed. All 15% off. And we will also have just some other stuff. There's a free Batman comic for as long as supplies last. Yep. First, like 200 people in the door will get a free Batman comic. And we will also have, there's an activity kit that they're doing that has like coloring pages and connect the dots and all that stuff that they just sent out. It's an electronic kit. So what we'll probably do is if anyone wants to bring in a USB or give us an email address, we'll send it out and people can get a Dropbox link for it. But it is very cool looking. I looked through it yesterday and it's a really neat little activity packet that DC did this year. Hmm. So we will have all of that. And hopefully people will come out for that. We'll keep pushing that. That's a few weeks from now. Also, if anybody happens to be in way South Austin this Saturday morning, we are co-sponsoring. We're providing coloring books and crayons for ATX Fest's Best Saturday Morning Ever, which is a Hasbro's event they usually do at the ATX Fest. This year they're doing it as a separate event at Alamo Slaughter Lane. It is going to be from 9 a.m. to 11:30. They're going to show, I think, episodes of Transformers Rescue Bots and My Little Pony, and there's going to be cereal. I think you can come in your pajamas, and I will be set up there with a small table of selling stuff, and we're also going to be giving out free coloring pages.
Now, I have a question about this.
Yes.
Is this an event for big kids, or is this an event for little kids, or is this an event for anybody who enjoys the kid-like experience?
Kids of all ages, Dave.
Okay. That's exactly what I needed
yes,
to know.
Yes, exactly. Just like the Ringling Brothers Circus, if it wasn't full of animal mistreatment.
Yes.
I mean, I don't know. I haven't been to Alamo Slaughter in a while. For all I know, it is full of animal mistreatment.
Just beating an elephant in the corner. If you know what I mean.
And on that metaphor, we segue into the news. I wish I had something that was a good transition from that. I have no elephant related news.
Unfurl the trunk.
But we do have a lot of news this week.
Sure.
We got the trailer for Batman: Return of the Caped Crusader, the animated movie that's coming out in October. Yep. Did you guys watch the trailer?
Yeah, it was fun. Although I will say this, I'm like, Adam West does not sound like the voice of a young man.
No, he does not.
The visuals might be there, but but Adam's slowing down.
Maybe they'll speed him up in post. Using the same technique they get Alan using Alvin and the Chipmunks.
I think it can only work.
Because I don't know if people know this, but Alvin's regular voice sounds like James Earl Jones.
I think more Barry White, but whatever.
Yeah, but when you speed him up, sounds like Alvin.
Anyway, I think this is a fun idea. I'm not quite sure where it came from. I didn't know that it was happening, but I suspect somebody just threw out the idea, and they're like, sure.
There's an audience for it, for sure.
Yeah.
But it's got Adam Westbrook, Ward, and Julie Newmar, all as voices.
Yeah, what's interesting is that I think if they had done it, like, 10 years ago, I don't think it would have had much traction. But now that they've done so many animated movies, and they've done a lot of serious stuff, too.
Yeah.
It feels like they can play around a little bit. And the Batman 66 comics kind of reminded people of their sort of love for that era. And I also just feel like people have kind of, like, come around to enjoying the camp again and not feeling like... like it's the enemy anymore,
right? And I think that's the thing. Is for me, it says that maybe we're going to see things that aren't just New 52 animated. Like I would like to see some original DC stuff. I'd like to see some fun stuff.
Yep. You know, it'd be cool. We were talking about the need or wanting to see a comic book version of the Legion of Superheroes again.
Yeah,
a good Legion animated movie would be pretty awesome.
I agree.
I don't know if they've got it in them, but I'd like to see it tried.
Next up, we've got Runaways is going at Hulu.
This is crazy.
Is it definitely happening?
It is definitely happening. They've got a pilot and a plan to do more. So unless they really F up the pilot, they are going to do a series. They've got a series order ready. And the pilot is being done by Josh Schwartz from The OC and Chuck.
Yeah.
And Stephanie Savage. The two of them run Gossip Girl together.
Okay.
These are people who know how to make TV, and they're probably the right people to make Runaways.
I was going
to
say, they know TV. They also... he's plugged into, like...
Geek culture.
Yeah. And it's perfect.
Yeah.
I will be interested to see casting news on this one. So
me too.
So see who they get.
I don't know any young actors. I'm not going to know who anybody is.
Me neither. But but I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm fine with no names.
So here's a question, and I don't know if this is known yet, but is this going to be set in like the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or is it going to kind of be off on its own?
We don't know yet. I would guess.
I feel like it could be either.
I would guess more standalone.
I was going to say more Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., but
yeah.
It could be in there if they wanted it to be or not.
But the movies won't acknowledge it.
Right.
Mostly in the comic Runaways, though it was definitely in the Marvel Universe, they were mostly dealing with their own threats and stuff like that.
Yeah.
One of them had mutant powers, but that could be reinterpreted as any kind of, you know, genetic experiment or whatever you could...
Right. So I wonder if they'll do Inhumans.
If they decide to connect the dots with the cinematic universe, TV universe, any of that stuff, then yeah, that would make sense.
All right. Other news, also Marvel casting news. We got two big bits of news from Spider-Man Homecoming. The one that broke the internet is that Zendaya, I don't remember what her first name is. I keep thinking of Zenyatta from Overwatch. Right.
But anyway, the actress from one of those Disney shows.
From a Disney show, who I don't know, is playing Mary Jane.
No, right. I want Zenyatta from Overwatch to be playing Mary Jane.
I've seen this mashup online, yes. I'm really excited about this. She tweeted the picture of her with the red hair, and I'm like, oh, that's a good picture.
Although, if I'm not mistaken, that was like, it's a Photoshop, right?
Is it?
That's what I read. It was like a regular photo that had just been Photoshopped to redden it up.
Because here's the thing. I don't need Mary Jane to be a redhead.
I don't think that's necessary either. I do feel like her sort of vivaciousness and her kind of it girl thing is her sort of her defining characteristics.
Yes. I'm interested to see how much Spider-Man Homecoming seems to be. It's set in Queens, and one of the things people have somewhat complained about with Spider-Man is that a teenager from Queens is more likely to be African American. That they sort of had co-opted the African-American experience by making Peter Parker white in the first place. Right. And that there's a lot of African-American cast. There's Hannibal Tabu, there's Donald Glover, and Bokeem Woodbine from Fargo Season 2 is the Shocker.
That's a great cast.
Which is, oh man, he's so good.
I wonder if there is any chance that this movie is going to stealth set up Miles Morales.
I absolutely believe that's going to happen.
And so that like in like the teaser thing, they're going to cut back and you're going to see some kid who's sweating it out saying, you know, he's like, you know, talking to his parents like, oh yeah, I snuck off to that science thing. I wasn't supposed to.
I think it's more. I don't think they're going to go that far. I think it's more likely that they're already
going to be like a classmate.
I think they're planning ahead. No, I don't think they're going to classmate. I think they're planning ahead. I think we'll meet as his parents. Huh? And this is just speculation, but I'm betting like Donald Glover and someone else are playing Miles Morales' parents,
or the Prowler. And
that, or the Prowler, well, his uncle, whatever.
Yeah.
And that Miles Morales will be a kid, and that he'll be set up so that he can age and become Spider-Man when they get to Spider-Man 4.
Right.
Like, they're thinking that far ahead. I think that's possible.
And I imagine that they probably that they will not see themselves as being written into the ultimate scenario where Peter Parker has to die for Miles to appear.
Yeah.
I think that they will probably do what more like what the current Marvel Universe is doing, which is if they bring in Miles, they'll be two Spider-Men.
Yeah. The thing is, I think that Peter Parker as a mentor to Miles or as an inspiration to Miles works a lot better than Peter Parker as a peer. So I don't know that Peter as a teenager and Miles as a teenager works, but maybe it would. I could see a version of it that would.
Right. I mean, how would you think they would do it otherwise?
I think they'll be setting up because they know that Holland Taylor, isn't that the name? Tom Holland, ballpark, is playing Spidey. He's going to get older.
Yeah.
And then by, you know, three movies in, that's going to be like 8 years. He'll be
a hideous man of like 22.
Yes. Well, he'll be college age at that point. At that point, you can introduce Miles as the new high school's Peter Parker, as the new high school Spider-Man, and have them do that mentor role a little bit. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's speculation. We don't really know.
You know, if they go that route, since his uncle is a major figure in there,
yeah.
And is also the in the Ultimate Universe was the Prowler,
yeah.
I can see them having a like just as a small sequence with his uncle in it.
Yeah, I can see that too.
Where you see him out robbing stuff. Peter Parker or Spider-Man maybe lets him go because he sees he's doing it for a kid,
and, right?
You know, like you know just. Get him through school or whatever.
Or webs him up and sends him to prison, and that's how he gets to prison.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. You could do any number of things, but I suspect it'll be... I'm going to put my money down. Prowler will be the connection.
We'll see. I think that's a good thought.
I'm more worried about this feeling... have too many villains in the mix, because they've got a lot of people in this movie.
Well, what villains do we know are for sure in it? Vulture?
Shocker and Vulture. That's only two. Okay. I mean, the too many villains is a real concern. I think you're right. That's absolutely something to be worried about.
That feels like what they've done in like when Universal was making Spider-Man, or was it Columbia? I forget.
It was Sony.
That was Sony.
Yeah, remember the same people we're making now?
Yeah, that's true.
I can understand that.
Just don't want too many. But
they have gotten better with the... algorithm for that, though, at least in some of the Marvel movies, you know, we saw that they were actually able to pretty deftly handle 8 million heroes in Civil War. But it is different with villains because you want villains to chew up the scenery and really dominate the scenes they're in. So it's a little trickier, but we'll see.
Well, one of the things Dave's always talked about was the notion of opening with a villain. Like the Bond sequence, basically.
Right.
You open with a villain, that villain gets taken down, and then that's it for that villain.
Right.
And I think that might be something they would do with one of these villains.
Have they ever done that yet? Because I still love the idea.
It's a great idea.
A Bond-type opening.
Yeah. Not really, I don't think so.
I
mean, sort of, Civil War sort of opens with that, in that it's...
Yeah, it's true. They're after, what's his name?
But it ties into the main story.
Yeah,
Age of Ultron did it.
I can't think of that guy's name.
Age of Ultron?
Yeah, Age of Ultron, they took...
Oh, that's right, they take Tumber and Strucker, yeah.
And Crossbones, that's what I was trying to...
And Crossbones and Civil War.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's a good idea and something we might see.
So, you know, I'm not sure how much the internet actually broke over a black actress playing Mary Jane.
There was definitely some...
That was sort of the anti-outrage internet machine.
I definitely saw some of it. I had to go looking for it, though, and I definitely saw a lot more of my feed was people saying the anti-outrage, which, of course, that's the kind of people I'm friends with, so that makes sense.
But, the greater fear, I think, that is a somewhat legit one is a Disney actress ready to pull off something a little bit heavier like this?
Yeah, here's the thing. Disney's actresses, and I say this as someone who's watched a lot of Disney TV because of my daughter.
Because of your daughter.
they're actually Disney is very good at what they do, and they're good at picking teen actresses. So, when they grow up, they become pretty good actors.
When I have peeked in on Disney stuff, though, it feels like they have a very sort of formulaic style, which is kind of the very quippy teens, and it's a sort of a it's almost like Disney's Aaron Sorkin style.
I agree.
And I'm just like I'm trying to think which ones have. Translated into notable actresses.
Yeah,
or
I mean
actors for that matter.
I'd have to go back. I don't know that well, but I know that a lot of the actresses we know, I think That's not Jennifer Lawrence, but there are people who have become
Most of
major
them, I think,
actresses
of becoming singers.
Yeah,
and then sometimes becoming actresses from that.
Yeah, I don't track Disney that well, so I can't give you any names.
But yeah, I haven't heard anything that bugged me. I think hopefully she'll be able to pull off the role. I actually don't think you want to glam her up too much because honestly, it's high school, and if you go too far with that, it gets into creepy territory. Maybe.
Yeah.
Peter Parker is such kind of a geeky dude. Especially if they go with kind of what they did in the thing, that I think if MJ is like a total bombshell, like the supermodel that she became in the 90s, which was really supposed to be in like her 20s for the character, that is a weird thing for Peter to luck into in high school.
Not if he's like tutoring her, which I think is sort of, or if she's the girl who he gets introduced to, she's out of his league. They're and she likes him for whatever reason.
Right.
So I don't know.
We don't know if they're going to do Gwen.
We don't. They've already done Gwen recently, so they may not.
It's true. It would make sense to kind of veer away from that for a little bit.
All right. Jumping back into comics, speaking of the casting, Riri Williams is going to become Iron Man, but she is not a man. And so they have announced that her name is going to be Ironheart.
No, all right, we were
not Iron Maiden.
They talked about that. You saw that, right?
I did.
That they actually like seriously. It sounds like they seriously discussed Iron Maiden, and they're like, "Wait a minute, we can't do that. That's going to be a problem."
It would have been pretty kick ass.
Yeah,
but I guess they said like the legal thing would have been a pain in the butt.
And Iron Woman just sounds weird, and it does.
Yeah,
and Iron Girl is just bad.
Iron Girl is just bad.
How about Iron Lassie?
Iron Lassie.
And then she was a Legion of Superheroes.
Yes,
it would be Iron Lass.
Yeah.
I like this name.
I do too. The only thing that struck me, and I know that they said they're going to like tie it in a little bit to like maybe even to Tony Stark's sort of heart issues specifically.
Yeah.
I don't know quite how that connects to her, but whatever. It does sound a little bit like an 80s name for a female character. The guy would get Iron Bolt or something kind of cool sounding, and she'd be like, "I'm Ironheart." How they kind of like,
I can see that. I guess
in that era they tended to soften the female heroes a lot.
It's reasonable.
And I have enough faith in them to it's a fine name. It only sounded, and my first reaction was, it sounds like a throwback.
Interesting, because Ironheart to me sounds like a male name.
It does.
Yeah, no, I see what you're saying. I think. If you think about it within the sort of traditionally female context, more caring, heartfelt kind of notion, then it becomes a more feminine thing. But yes, I think that.
But the combined, the Ironheart, I mean, wasn't that a Van Damme movie? Ironheart? Lionheart.
Lionheart.
He was Lionheart.
That's close.
Right.
But
Ironheart as a word, as one word, has a different meaning. And I think that's.
Right.
That is what you're not wrong. I think it's an interesting point. But I don't know what the better choice was. You can't just call her Iron Man.
Yeah.
Unless she's pretending to be a man, baby.
I would call her Irona.
That's much better. How about Irona 2000?
Yes.
Irona Z.
I guess the other possibility would have been to do something that doesn't have iron in it at all. Like the, unfortunately, I think slightly lame Rescue. Isn't that the name?
Rescue's a terrible name.
Pepper Potts.
Yes. Rescue's a terrible name.
And it was a terrible name. I will say that I'm sure they could have come up with something better than Rescue, but I think continuing the iron lineage was a good idea.
Yeah.
So I think this is going to be a good idea.
They could have called her Lady Rescue. She Iron Man.
So are they changing the name of the book now?
No, the book is still going to be called Invincible Iron Man.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I feel like they should go ahead and change it because that seems A, prime to just annoy the man babies who are going to be upset that a woman's taking over. And it seems slightly disrespectful to her to have her, it's like she's still coasting on his lineage.
I agree, but in the market we have, an Invincible Iron Man number one is going to sell better than an Ironheart number one.
Also, I wonder if they might be planning to transition it over after, 6 issues or 12 issues, when she's sort of firmly established.
Well, we know one thing about this, which is we know that Tony Stark is going to be the basis for her Jarvis AI. We don't know what that means for Tony Stark post-Civil War II, but we do know that.
But it sounds like he's like, I'm quitting, I'm dead, I'm something.
Yeah,
he's something. Somewhat, for some reason, maybe out of the picture. Or maybe he's just like sort of retired from the public life of superheroing to go work purely in tech.
Right. All right. We have Wonder Woman is going to officiate a gay wedding.
right?
This was in Newfound, Dave, so...
Sure, it's... what I remember is that it's from the... what is it? Sensation?
Yeah, the online comics? Sensation comics, yeah.
Yeah, which means it'll be translated into a print comic in, what, like, 4 months or something.
Something like that, like yeah. That.
But there is a page going around. You can find it if you just Google Wonder Woman Gay Wedding. Yeah. It's going to turn it up. And that's an anthology series. Each issue has, like, I think, like 2, maybe 3 short stories.
Yeah.
They can be any sort of era or setting. They could do retro wartime Wonder Woman, or they could do the, you know, a modern take, or almost more of an animated take.
Yeah.
In any case, this looks like it's, you know, relatively kind of like a modern DC universe in that one, and you see her in the clip I've seen officiating at a gay wedding, exactly what it sounds like.
So here's what I want to know.
Did you see the panels, by the
no,
way?
No, I did not.
That's sort of the notable lines of dialogue where somebody's talking and he's saying, oh, he's like, this is really cool, and she's saying that she, you know, she likes doing this, or, you know, that her work doesn't offer her much time, but I guess, like, as in what, ambassador or whatever, she has in some way she has the legalese.
That's what I was wondering about. I'm like, how does Wonder Woman get to marry people? Because she's a princess, but I don't think princesses have that power.
Yeah.
Do ambassadors? I
don't know. I forget what they said. Or maybe it's like some special thing that she was granted. Or maybe she went,
like, every nation has given her the ability to do this.
Maybe she went out and got a license.
I'm just saying, Superman can't marry people. It's a weird thing that Wonder Woman can.
He's not an ambassador.
That's true. He's not.
He's just some... last son of Krypton.
He's just one of those filthy immigrants from Krypton just come here to take our jobs.
I know. Put up a wall. Stop yeah. that guy. He's going to fly right through that mother.
Lex Luthor's going to build a kryptonite wall. And Star Labs is going to pay for it.
Anyway, he said something like, you know, it makes sense. He's like, but I didn't know you supported gay marriage.
Yeah.
And she says, she's like, I come from a, you know, an island of all women. It's like, on our world, you know, on our island, we just call it marriage.
That has been fan speculation for a long time, and it seems like they're sort of steering into that finally.
Just pulling into it. Although, yeah. Interestingly, because Sensation Comics is technically everything in there is kind of out of continuity.
It's true.
Or in continuity if you want it to be. It's still not like 100% official, but I suspect they will run with it.
Right, but Rucka's made it more or less official in his book, too.
Right.
So, I think it's the right decision. For one thing, I think it's the right decision, but beyond your politics, gay marriage, Wonder Woman has always had a huge following in the gay community.
Right.
And I think to acknowledge that and to make her sort of a gay-friendly character is just, makes perfect sense.
Right. Yep, I agree. I thought it was cool. It was nicely drawn, it's a worthy headline for the character.
All right, Lost Boys.
Yeah,
the movie we all like. We talked about the comic last week when we were talking about the previews. It is getting a possible TV reboot from Rob Thomas, who does iZombie, right. The Veronica Mars. On the CW, which is the right place for a Lost Boys show.
Yes, it is.
But the concept for it is so good because the notion is that it's going to – each season will take place in a different era and that the characters will change around. It will be almost an anthology except that the Lost Boys themselves, because they're ageless, will be the same characters.
Right.
I think that's a great pitch for a show.
It's a cool idea, although I don't know if I particularly – I mean, do we think that the vampires are going to be the focus?
Yes, the vampires will be the focus, I believe.
It's weird because they mostly seem like a bunch of scumbags.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that. I assume that the characters they'll bring in each season will be also part of the focus too.
Right, there's got to be like other people weaving in and out of their stories, but it's going to allow them first of all to do period pieces.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, '80s is the obvious place to start.
I wonder, are they going to acknowledge the movie at all, or are they just going to maybe retell some of the movie whenever they do their '80s era one?
I don't know.
I bet they don't acknowledge it. I bet they just do their own thing.
You think they'll start in the 80s and do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think Rob Thomas is the perfect person to get to do this. I mean, the way he looks at things is just really interesting, and it'll be poppy like the movie was.
Remind me what Rob Thomas is?
Veronica Mars, iZombie, yep. Cupid. He's good TV is what Rob Thomas does. I'm excited about this. I hope that it goes forward, because iZombie's been great.
Yeah. I'm neutral on the idea.
Fair enough.
I'm just not quite sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if the vampire focus is like, because, you know, the family was what I loved about Lost Boys. Now, I did like the vampires. They were great antagonists. Kiefer Sutherland in particular was a fantastic villain. Vampire was a fantastic villain. I can imagine lots of stuff you can do with that, and especially in the sort of post, I guess, True Blood era. a more nuanced take on these. You know, even in the story, you saw the girl and the little kid,
yeah,
who were not like necessarily stone cold killers,
right?
So there's lots of stuff you could do with it. I'm just, I guess I want to see a trailer.
Well, I hope that they do a season where every line of dialogue is Michael. If people don't know what I'm talking about, there's a video. Just do a Google search.
Lost Boys Michael YouTube.
Yeah, something like that. You'll find it. It is surreal and funny.
Yeah.
Okay. The Overwatch put out a new short this week. It was The Last Bastion. It was their. It was one of their cinematics. Yeah. And
probably the most Pixar-esque of all of them so far.
Yeah.
And for someone who does not follow or know the game as well like me, Bastion is their big robot dude.
Yep.
And this short is very much an Iron Giant kind of thing. He's a weapon, and it's whether or not he's going to be a weapon anymore.
Yeah, it's very sweetly told, and with that same pacing that you would expect from Pixar.
Yeah.
Where it begins with this bird flying through the forest, and it lands on, you know, like a rock or something, and it's like pecking away at it, and you see a little bit of like foliage fall away, and you realize that this is a this is Bastion the robot that is, you know, all completely overgrown with trees, defunct for many years seemingly.
Mm-hmm.
And it also sort of follows their bond, you know.
Yeah.
It's a sort of bond in nature which tears away from his bond of destruction and war. Right.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Remind me, what was the deal with why are robots?
He was part of the Omnics.
The Omnics were the robots who gained sentience and tried to take over. That's what Overwatch was formed to defeat.
Okay.
And so he was sort of one of the many foot soldiers of the Omnics. Think of him as a Terminator, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
What I think is interesting is that
he's an adorable Terminator.
In playing the game, we've all come to hate Bastion because Bastion's one of the cheater characters. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'll play him, but I feel a little dirty every time I do.
No, I don't. I like him.
You should.
Kind of overpowered.
You should feel bad.
Is he just overpowered?
He's very overpowered. He turns into a turret. You can gun down many people with him.
He's a self-healing turret.
Yeah, he's a self-healing turret. It's messed up. But this made me want to play him more. I'm like, oh, now I see the character a little more.
And that's the thing. This is basically first-person shooter.
Yeah,
that's
all Overwatch. It's a team-based shooter.
But there's a lot more to the story.
Yeah,
we're slowly getting it.
The deeper they put the more they put the personality, it sort of informs the way I play the game. Even though the game is not really, it doesn't really reward you role playing in any way.
No.
But you sort of get the way they interact, and they do things like the dialogue interacts and
but
that kind
of
thing.
I feel like I have a stronger connection to the characters once I learn their backstory, see their interaction, especially in like the beginning before the match. They're talking to each other, like you just mentioned.
Yeah.
Especially like when they put in Anna just recently, where you here talking to Soldier 76 and sort
or
of
Reinhardt.
Their bond, or Reinhardt, or Farrah.
Before you get the backstory, they're just like a piece of meat with a gun.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, yes. But, I mean, Blizzard has said they're going to continue to do these shorts as long as people are interested in them.
Yay!
Which is fantastic.
They're doing a comic or something, right?
They're doing a digital book that's going to be put into print at beginning of next year.
Next year, yeah.
Is there any chance it's going to be any good?
There's a chance. Dark Horse is doing it. Dark Horse at least does solid.
Yeah. They're also doing their art book.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the art book.
I'm, like, super excited for that one. And they've said that all the stuff they're going to produce for the game is free.
Yeah, they're not doing. That's one thing I really like. DLC is sort of the model now. Everybody puts out paid DLC, so you basically by the time you're done, you've paid $150 for a game.
Yeah, like two games worth.
Yeah, but this, if you bought the game, you're getting all the free characters, all the new maps. Like it's all coming free, and I think that's
pretty
great.
Cool.
And I feel like they're also really responding to people's critiques of characters. Like,
yes,
if somebody's overpowered, they'll go back and tweak it a little bit, or
yeah,
if they feel they're underpowered. We've done that with a couple of characters, and I just think it's fantastic.
Well, they also do the hilarious thing on the PC servers where, you know, some people will type GG easy, which is like good game, but easy. It was like, it's a way to taunt people, like you sucked, and it's like you sucked, and we ran all over you.
Oh.
Well, now if you type GG easy, it comes out as it's something
like, I'm a big whiny baby.
Yeah, or something like that, basically, yeah. Yeah, it's
the point is, I guess the message still gets through if you're playing the game and you know what that means.
But you know that it's going to be driving them crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but the people who are like, oh, I'm so good, and then they type in this kind of really stupid sounding thing.
Yeah, that's hilarious.
Yeah, it's sort of, I think, shows their, and you know, they bounced all the cheating codes out of there and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, they're pretty big on that.
Yeah, so I like Blizzard. I like the way they do things.
Yes.
And I love that game. It's one of my favorites. Big news. Okay, one more thing on this on the video game front. And I know that with Overwatch, like you and I, Nick, got into Overwatch, and Dave, you sort of fell off of Battlefront a little bit. Mm-hmm. But we all have the Death Star DLC coming to us in September because we pre-bought the DLC for the year. And the Death Star DLC coming for Battlefront sounds super cool. So it's going to have a new mode called Battle Station with three phases. In phase one, you fly X-Wings and A-Wings against TIE Fighters and TIE Interceptors in space. The main objective is for the Rebels to destroy enough TIE Fighters until their Y-Wing support can come in to weaken the Star Destroyer's defenses. Once vulnerable, Rebel Starfighters can attack the weak spots in an effort to bring the Star Destroyer down. In an effort to help defend this key asset for the Empire, players along with AI ships will be set up to help defend the Star Destroyer. So basically, it's a combination of fighter squadron and walker assault in space.
Which is awesome.
At no point, no first-person shooting at that.
No, that is like starships. It's like, starships.
That's cool. You know,
that's phase one.
Is that okay? Yeah. What else?
Phase two, players fight inside the space station among areas inspired by the classic trilogy. Rebel infantry will be tasked with extracting a priority droid from within the Death Star. Amidst the chaos of battle, you'll be able to gain an advantage by taking up arms as our new heroes, Bosk and Chewbacca. And then phase three, you head back into space, so the Rebels need to end the battle once and for all by blowing up the Death Star. Players have become the hero of the Rebellion, Luke Skywalker, and his Red 5 X-Wing, as they attempt to destroy the Empire's ultimate weapon. But beware, as Darth Vader has been dispatched to protect the Empire's asset in his TIE Advanced. So, heroes in space battles, which is a new thing, and trying to blow up the Death Star. That's fun. That's going to have, like, trench runs and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And this is all, basically, it's like, it sounds like you may get an advantage if you win one phase onto the next one, but it's a really cool idea.
Yeah, it's kind of, I think, one of those things that we talked about when we were first playing the game, and we're like, the ship combat is pretty fun just on its own, but repetitive.
Yeah.
And it'll be like, oh man, what if it was, it's all surface-based, like, what if it was up, and there was some stuff up in space?
And now it is.
What if there was some stuff with capital ships?
Yeah.
So, yeah. I'll be fascinated to see that, because I assume they're going to be pretty awesomely to scale, meaning that, you know, it's going to take, like, a while to try and fly over a Star Destroyer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the Star Destroyer will more or less be part of the map, I would say.
Yeah.
Yeah. It sounds like fun. All right. Back to comics. And kind of big news that dropped is that Robert Kirkman is ending Invincible.
Yep.
It ends, I think, next year. They're starting its story. They're in the story right now. It's going to be a 12-part story, and the 12th part is the finale. Robert Kirkman has always said he's not going to end books. Like, he had this famous quote, which is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, by the way. But his quote was like, I hope that when I'm an old man, I can read an issue of Invincible and throw it across the room because it's not Invincible. And I'm like, why would you hope for that?
Yeah.
It's so typical of Kirkman, who grew up on 90s comics. It's like, he had nostalgia for the experience, even to the parts he didn't like.
Yeah.
Like, he loved the idea of a character that he created being taken and done wrong. And I don't get that, even on a nostalgic level.
Well, I don't know if he was kind of just talking about how, like, you know, if you hand off a character to somebody else, inevitably there's, you know, there's going to be some screw-up, but, you know, it's like, you know, Daredevil is eventually going to also find its Frank Miller and those other writers. And it's just that, that means you'll have to go through the pain at some point of some crap-ass writers.
I'm just saying, I would have probably used the example of, I would like it to find its Frank Miller.
Yes. Yes. It was a weird place to jump to.
But he decided that what he wanted, his argument was, and I don't know if he thought people would be upset with him. Maybe they are.
Maybe he just ran out of ways to have people getting their heads punched
off. I think it's possible. You would think that wouldn't happen, but he may have. Was that he said, Invincible's always been a different superhero comic. We've always done we've always done the opposite of what people would expect. And he said, you know, whereas most superhero comics go on forever, having an ending is sort of the opposite of that. And I'm like, that makes sense. Yeah. Also, it's a better way to do your independent comic.
Right.
Have an ending.
Yeah. In particular, you know, Image does not generally, they do not farm out their stuff to freelancers and stuff like that. It's not that it hasn't happened. There have been other people who've written Spawn and done Spawn miniseries, and then huge, painful lawsuits that have resulted from that.
Sure. Uh-huh.
But at Marvel and DC, where there is definitely, I mean, just purely on for IP alone, these guys want to perpetuate the characters.
Yeah.
But also, it is cool to see them go through different hands and see the evolution and contemporizing of their settings. But if you've got control of it from the beginning and you can it only makes sense to me to see it, an ending at some point.
Yeah, I honestly, I think that...
there's almost nothing I want to read 400 issues of.
Bringing new people onto a book to take it forward where they don't create, they don't own it, it seems anathema to what Image is supposed to be about.
Right.
So, yeah, it's... I'm glad to see this. What I really like, and I don't know that I want this as a businessman, but as creatively speaking, I've always felt like Walking Dead needs an ending.
Yeah,
they need, if nothing else, they need to stop that story and pick up with some new characters in the same setting.
If they could stop the Rick story,
yeah.
Dear God, Rick's gone through enough problems.
Yeah,
he's seen too much.
I want a story where Rick becomes a zombie, and we see 200 issues of Rick as a zombie. How about that? I think that's where we're more likely to go.
Oh no, my zombie wife is cheating with my zombie best friend.
Oh no, my zombie arm got cut off.
We are the Walking Dead. Like, really, I'm a zombie. And...
I can't deal with my zombie son. I just don't understand him.
Zombie Carl, no.
It's funny, this new direction seems vaguely familiar. Wow. But yes, I do think that'd be a good idea. There's... You know, maybe as much as he kind of wants to sort of, I know, show the realism of, like, you know, the long haul, the, you know, oh, well, you know, if you were really stuck in this situation for years, it would break you down. But he also still has a heightened drama so that, like, every camp they go to is some exciting and crazy new bad guy. Right. And that the artifice of that, the kind of the number of arch villains and stuff that they faced, means that it gets a little ridiculous if one guy has experienced all this in his life and is still standing at all.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think at some point you're going to have to get away from that character.
I'm just waiting for the aliens. Can the aliens show up?
You know, that was the original pitch.
I know that was. That's why I brought it up.
I don't know if people know that. The original pitch was that the aliens were behind The Walking Dead.
I just want them to show up. Just that would be the big twist.
And I believe the word was that Kirkman just said that to get it made. Like, he thought that the twist is something that like, the editors would like, well, and it was.
That's what he said. But Eric Stevenson at Image said, no, we were never on board that. So neither one of them is taking credit for it. Now, that may just be because it doesn't sound like neither one of them want to be the one blaming for we almost had aliens in our Walking Dead comic.
Right.
But I feel like, knowing what I know about Kirkman, it was probably him who was excited about it, and Image, like, steered him away once it was hugely successful. Like, can we maybe not do the aliens?
Can we just do the perpetual sadness that he's watching?
He was just one step from having the AK-AK aliens from Mars Attacks as the creators.
You know, at that point, I might, if that happened, I would probably go back to reading
Walking Dead. That would be the greatest prank, the greatest trolling of all time.
Tim Burton's AK-AK aliens.
Yes.
All right. Finally, one bit of news, a trailer that we saw for the Arrival.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't watch this.
Did you not watch it? It's a good trailer.
And then I got lost.
Is it just... Is it Arrival?
Arrival.
Because there was previously a The Arrival starring Charlie Sheen.
You're right. This is
which
just
Which is actually a movie I like, but it's kind of a B-grade sci-fi movie.
It was a fun little time, but I don't...
To briefly flash back to this, like, mid or late 90s movie, Charlie Sheen was, like, a cable repairman, kind of on the outs, I think, with his wife, who picks up weird signals while he's doing his cable repair one day. And he retasks all the little satellite dishes in everybody's yard to, like, basically do the equivalent of, like, what those big satellite arrays do in a local way. And he uncovers that there has been, like, weird alien infiltration on Earth. It's actually a smarter movie than you would expect given the presence of Charlie Sheen.
I was going to say, nowadays, Charlie Sheen actually does go out and mess with his neighbor's dishes to pick up alien signals. But that's because he's on cocaine.
That's just his life, man.
Yeah.
That's just hashtag winning.
You are right. This is called Arrival.
Right. And it looks to be more in the vein of, like, something like Contact.
Yeah.
Where it seems like it's a fairly serious thing about a, like, linguistics expert, I think she is.
Yeah, she's a linguistics expert. I can't remember who's playing her. Do you remember either?
I forget, too. I'm not sure if it is somebody.
It's somebody good. Yeah, I don't know. I'll look it up.
Who's the actress who played Lois Lane in...
Amy Adams. It is Amy Adams. You're right. Yep. Yeah. Yep.
An actress who deserves better and may be getting it with this. I've heard the book it's based on is good, or it's maybe a novella.
Okay.
And I've had a few friends recommend it, so that bodes well. I don't know much about the story. They were kind of cagey with it in the trailer, which is cool. It seems like there's these giant, like, sort of like egg-like, like long, but like the size of, like, buildings, or like the size of, like, battleships that are, like, suspended or hovering over the Earth. And
it also has Jeremy Renner and Forrest Whitaker. So
yeah, Forrest Whitaker's playing, like, a general who's there's very much that strain between the civilians and the military is like, let's blow it up, and she's like, let's try and understand it, let's communicate with them. Yep. And there's definitely a sort of a ticking clock where she's trying to analyze their language and explain to them that you know, we're peaceful so that they don't inadvertently start a war with an alien race that will probably wipe us out.
Right. And I gather there's like some detail given over to how the linguistic stuff works and how you kind of have to think in alien ways or figure out how to represent something in a way that would influence a mind completely different from ours. I am hopefully, you know, that like that's one of those things that could probably be really good as a book, but could be boring as a movie. And right. I got there's a strong suspense vibe to the trailer too.
The trailer's good.
I did get the impression that there's not going to be some boring ass science.
So this is based on a short story. It's called "Story of Your Life" by Ted Chiang.
Okay.
It won a Nebula Award for Best Novella in 1999.
Oh, okay.
Or in 2000, in 1990, won the Sturgeon Award. So, yeah, no, I have not heard
16 years
of this.
Old. Ugh, that's dusty. I don't know what I could possibly have to say to today's youth. but no, I'm really interested in it. I'm a big fan of Contact, and I will be interested to see what an alien movie looks like that does not result in, hopefully, in an invasion where there are not, like, American bro soldiers shooting them down.
Where's my Independence Day?
You had it, and it flopped.
Yeah.
Okay. Finally, I just want to mention that we do have Rogues Gallery Pokemon badges on the way.
Yes.
We don't know exactly when they get here. We haven't quite priced them yet, but if you go to our Facebook, you can see a picture, and they look great. I think they're going to turn out really good.
Yeah, I was happy to see people seem to be responding very well to them and excited about them, as they should be.
And they're not just Pokemon badges. They also can serve as like a badge of the store. It's a little close on pin. So.
Yeah, it has the it's like the sort of silhouette of our mascot, Maximilian Larch, store rogue. But for this purposes, he's the gym trainer.
Yep. All right. We'll be back in just a second to talk comics for the week. We are talking comics for the week of Wednesday 24th. And once again, if you have not come into the store and it is before 12:30 on Wednesday 24th, you could come in from 12:30 to 1:30. Cully Hamner is going to be here signing Blue Beetle Rebirth number 1. Yep. If it is past 1:30 on Wednesday the 24th, you should still come in for all these awesome comics. But the signing went great. Was fantastic. Really good.
Fantastic. I'm still, my right shoulder is a little painful from the gunshot wound.
Yeah, I did think it was weird that we turned into a Blue Beetle fight club. that was a little strange, but other than that.
Not to use guns in the fight club.
Yes. Yeah. But other than that, went great.
Great.
Okay, so picks. Nick, why don't you start us off this week?
All right. So I don't think I've ever picked a Valiant book.
Have you not?
No, okay. I don't think I have. But
you know what's interesting, by the way? This is going to be at least a double Valiant week.
Yep.
Which will be double Valiant Day.
Yep, so continue.
No, but mine is a book called Generation Zero, Number One. And this is just a cool book all around. It's Fred Van Lente writing, so he wrote a lot of the Marvel All Ages books, didn't he?
He did. He also wrote the Incredible Hercules run that we all loved.
Which was
Greg
fantastic.
Pop. Yep.
But this one is sort of about a high school student in a small town that was destroyed and rebuilt as... What do they call it? Redneck Dubai? Isn't that what they call it? Basically, it is coined that.
How did this town get destroyed?
I think it was a Psyot a war or something.
Yeah,
like
a war. Right.
So it's superhero-y stuff.
Yeah, and it's sort of tied into some of the bigger Valiant stuff, but about a teenager who's kind of realized that there is a problem with this town.
It's and almost like Invaders of the Body Snatchers.
A little bit mixed with a little bit of Matrix.
I didn't have time to read this morning, and I really wanted to, and now I like really, really want to, because Invasion of Body Snatchers, one of my favorite
But the
movies.
Deal is she, you know, finds this out through a boyfriend, and the boyfriend mysteriously dies, and she goes looking for something that to aid her.
Yeah.
And... she, it's very interesting. The people, it's called Generation Zero, and that's who she goes looking for because they're supposed to answer the call and help people.
Yeah, it's almost like this urban legend for kids. They like, they you go on the internet, and if you need help, you go and you call for Generation Zero. And they're like these, it's this weird mix of like Anonymous and the A-Team.
Yeah. It's got this kind of 80s vibe to the entire book, which I think is interesting.
You know what else is in the DNA of this book very much is Pump Up the Volume.
Yes.
The sort of notion of teen rebellion and that the authorities do not have your best interest in mind. It is a very sort of interesting, almost millennial focused book.
Yeah.
Like a millennial Pump Up the Volume.
But
yeah.
I never saw that. So real quick, Pump Up the Volume, remind me.
Renegade DJ plays alternative music and galvanizes the kids against a repressive regime.
Got it. Love it.
But I think what grounds this issue is the fact that it focuses on one person.
Yes.
And that's a character named Keisha and sort of her family, especially her younger brother, who's kind of autistic in some ways, yeah. but definitely sort of has an ability to himself, it seems. And it sort of focuses on her trying to figure all this out, figure the problems out. And it's just kind of cool with her relationship with her father. And I don't know, everything about it was really cool. The art is nice. And it's
who's the artist on this?
Francis Portella.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But there's also just some cool characters.
It's very tightly realistic. You know, in a weird way, it reminds me, as a present-day version, of how Valiant books looked in the 90s.
Yeah.
I mean, in the sense that the craft level is, so high.
Yeah.
This
also, the thing I liked about it, you don't have to read anything Valiant to read this. This very much feels
I'm certainly
its own.
Not up to date. Right.
The same thing that I've noticed about Faith in the past.
Yeah, I'm not up to date with things. I could see some ties to other books, I guess, but I didn't know those things, and I still wasn't lost, so...
Yeah.
That was definitely
if it's
helpful.
Anything like Faith has been for me at times, it actually made me kind of fascinated by the world. It was cool because it felt like it was part of that bigger superhero setting, which is something that, as you know, Marvel and DC fans, we've all enjoyed that vibe, that shared universe vibe. But it's kind of cool when you hit it in media res. I don't need to hear the origin of the universe or anything to see a little small intersections with it.
Well, this also reminds me of that first issue of Runaways.
Yeah.
Where it's in part of a larger universe, but you don't need to know anything about that universe to enjoy it.
Right, yeah. It was always kind of a little bit off to the side of the Marvel universe, so it was kind of it flirted with it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course this has a great sort of twist towards the end, and has one of those endings where wants me to have, I want the second issue.
Yeah.
And if a book does that, I know it's something good.
Nice.
So I'm very happy with it, and hence the pick.
Dave, you want to go ahead and hit your Valiant pick?
Yeah, sure. Let's do it. My pick is indeed the second issue of Faith.
Yep, the ongoing series.
Right. The ongoing series, which, and you know, I have been happy to see this, the series continue to just grow in readership. I've seen people buying the trade now that the trade of the first miniseries is out, and the new book has been great. It has revealed, I guess, the first true arch-villain for her.
It's so perfect.
And it's so perfect, and I don't want to reveal who it is, because it's too good. But it's very fitting for the character, and this issue is sort of a capture scenario.
Yeah,
I'm going to try to avoid any major spoilers, but Faith is sort of held in the bad guy's lair and has to figure out her way out of it. Even as you find out some interesting backstory to the bad guy and where their motivations come from, there's a line in here that made me laugh out loud. That was a fantastic, both an awesome moment and a funny geek moment for Faith, who, you know, as her defining characteristic is definitely her nerdiness.
Yeah.
But in you were saying earlier, Randy, it feels like the writer is coming at it from a more legit standpoint, not sort of like a, hey, I heard geek culture is kind of hip these days. I'm going to write a nerdy character.
They're not checking boxes, and they're not doing the Bob Haney thing, which is a old reference, but where it's like, this is what an adult's version of teenager looks like. No, this is someone who knows nerd culture, and this character feels like she's been in nerd culture for a while. This is someone who binged Red Dwarf on Netflix.
Right.
This is someone who, you know, knows cosplayers.
Right.
It is very much this feels like a real nerd.
Yes, in fact, I'm going to, the cosplay thing reminded me, one bit I'm going to mention here. A friend of hers who knows her identity is talking about how, now that she knows it's her, she's like, oh, I'm making a cosplay costume based on you, and she's like, and I want to get some details right, And, you know, Faith is very sort of taken aback by this. Yeah. And she's like, she's still reeling from the fact that, you know, this friend might know her identity and stuff. And she's like, oh, I guess I could bring the costume over before our next gaming session. So, like, before D&D, they play D&D, she's going to show off her superhero costume so they can get the cosplay of it, right?
Yeah.
It was geeky in all the right ways.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Still continues to be really beautifully drawn. I love the designs on her. They don't shy away from her curves, but it's all the characters are rendered. It's again, it reminds me of the best side of Valiant of the 90s, which is to say you take these artists that are just kind of expert storytellers that can draw whatever you throw their way and can draw like big larger-than-life action and fight scenes or a supervillain's lair, but who can also do these great down-to-earth conversational scenes too, and have characters that are very believably, you know, visual, their expressions and all that stuff sell a lot. The visuals alone tell a lot there. So, yeah, you're going to want to, like, there's a special thing going on this week.
So if anyone who picks up Faith number 2 will get a Faith number 1 for free. Yeah. And in fact, we have Faith number 1s to give for free. So all you need to do is ask for one. If by chance you picked up Faith number 1, this is a good excuse to grab a free one and give it to a friend.
Yeah.
Valiant basically in trying to sort of push this book has gave us a stack of sort of free versions of Faith number 1. We're going to send them out to people and hopefully people can get on board this book because we really like it.
Yep. And with those two issues, you're going to get essentially both a kind of a recap of the character's origin. You're going to find out her deal in the first issue and you're going to see this great supervillain showdown in the second issue.
Yep.
All right, so that's my pick.
All right,
there.
And, my pick Brandon, is what do you got? My pick is an Image book. It is Lake of Fire number 1. This is written and colored by a veteran colorist Nathan Fairbairn, and illustrated by Matt Smith, who's a guy I've always thought of as having sort of a Mignola-esque style. This is not that style. It's actually a little more Chris Samney-ish.
I also say, who's that guy? Mike Norton?
Mike Norton, and also a little bit of that, remember Leave It to Chance? Was that Paul Smith?
Paul Smith, yeah, doing his kind of slightly his clean line all ages.
It's funny that you mentioned the Mike Mignola thing, though, because when I first picked this up and was thumbing through it, I was like, oh, this kind of reminds me of, like, Fafford and the Grey Mouser.
I do remember you saying that. And I think part of that is the way he spots shadows in.
Yeah, it's his inking style.
His layout, and also, like, that layout and knowledge of, what do they call it, spotting blacks in comics. Mm-hmm. Is to control.
Is that what you call it when you do all the giant X's where the black should be?
That's when you do the heavy ink fill-ins and stuff like that.
But also, you can tell this is a veteran colorist working on this because the colors are beautiful.
They are.
What book is about?
Because it's got a pretty cool hook.
This book is essentially Knights Templar versus aliens.
Right.
That's not where it starts. It starts off. We see what looks like a big spaceship crashing on this sheep herder, and then we jump back to this young knight and his squire, excuse me, a friend of his, and this knight is, it will come to be revealed, is sort of he's a prince who is headed off to the front lines of this siege. He was supposed to be staying at home and becoming king, but he didn't want to do that. He was bored by it, so he got himself promoted to a knight and headed out to the front lines where his mother sends an advisor to come get him, and the commander of the troops basically doesn't want all these people in the way, so they hitch up this guy, his young squire, and his older mentor, and they send along with this sort of drunken sot of a knight who turns out to be one of these Michael Ironsides from Starship Troopers, like grim warrior. He seems like maybe a burnout, but in fact he's like this grim Sarge, you know, the Sarge character.
I have to say, I always love that archetype.
Yeah.
It's always fun.
And they send all these guys out to look into some heresy going on in a small village. And what I love about this is, one of the things that all three of us love this movie, and everybody should love this movie, is aliens.
Yes.
When you're going to fight aliens, you want your Colonial Marines. You want characters that are defined, that you care about what happens to them.
Right.
And they do a really good job of establishing all these characters. I like all of them. There's the squire who's a little bit soft-hearted. There's the noble young man who's trying to prove himself. There's the older mentor who's basically just trying to get this kid to come back alive. And there's the sergeant who seems like this sort of no-nonsense jerk, but at the same time is very good at what he does. And they throw these guys into a situation which, spoilers, there's aliens. and the villagers react into, like, demons. But that is the start, and it's a good like double sized issue. I think it's 40 pages
because of the beautiful art in it. It reminded me almost of like a European album, you know, their more elaborate style of like sort of fantasy art and things like that.
But I know that it's, as Dave was reading it, it's sort of it starts off a little bit of heavy character stuff, and I think it didn't quite click with you.
Right. It was just one of those where I was like, instead of reading this in the sort of haste before the podcast, I'm going to, like, you know, read this at my leisure during the week sometime later.
But it's worth taking the time, because I know Nick read it and enjoyed it.
Yeah, I really, really enjoyed it.
And we've had a lot of people of late looking for sort of fantasy comics. Like, this is a straight-up Knights Templar, but instead of magic, there are aliens. And it's a... it's a really good first issue, so I'm excited to see where they go from
concept
here.
Concept-wise, that's way up my alley. A quick question about it. You know, the Knights Templar, you know, were deployed in Jerusalem, and they were fighting Islamic warriors. Is any of that, like, that's, you know, that feels like very contemporary, potentially, as far as, like, thematically. Is there you know, any drawing on that? Or
yes. They very much make reference to the Knights Templar as sort of a that they're a bit more puritanical, and there's sort of a question of whether their mission is just and that kind of thing.
Okay, like they get into a little bit of the nuance there.
Well, one of the people who's with them is the Sarge is sort of telling him about. He calls him a shave pate. He's an inquisitor, and he's basically telling these kids. He's like the younger boy is going to play a song.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, you don't want to do that. That man is an inquisitor boy, a hound of God. Every place he looks, all he can see is heresy. He hears you sing the wrong song, which is likely any song at all, and he may as well start to see it in you. And he said, he's basically saying, like, yeah, these guys, they're not much loved among the Crusaders. He's like, they see heresy everywhere, and if they can't find some poor Cathar bastard to burn alive for it, they start to look a little too closely at those around them.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's an interesting take on sort of the
Inquisition. Yeah, I was wondering if that'd be percolating and beneath the alien fighting.
Yep, they're absolutely doing a bit of that. It's really good.
Cool.
And then my backup pick is a book I've picked a few times lately, Captain Marvel number 8. This is Ruth Fletcher Gage and Christos Gage writing. Chris Anka on
husband and wife?
Yeah.
Okay. I'd forgotten that.
Chris Anka is doing the art. And this is basically, I almost think this is required reading for Civil War II. Because everyone who's complaining about Captain Marvel sort of being ruined by Civil War II, they're making her too rigid. This is where they're exploring her thought processes. This is where she talks to Philippe Belleau of Canada, who's on their advisory council, and Henry Peter Gyrich of the United States. And Black Panther is sort of getting on her case a bit about whether or not they should be doing this, even though he's on her team. And
is the Canadian guy, is that a real person, or is it the guy who's kind of based kind
he's
of...
He's definitely a riff on their current prime
Trudeau,
minister. Yeah, Trudeau.
Right, yeah.
So this is all about Captain Marvel questioning how they do things, how they interact with local law enforcement. She talks at one point about how they have a team of lawyers, diplomats, physicists, and ethicists to make sure everything's done right. This is the deep dive on how they do what they do, whether they should be using the Inhuman's
the
power.
The predictive power
Ulysses. Whether they should be using Ulysses' power or not, and if they're doing it the right way. And there's some sort of conflicted situations as they go in, and you're seeing sort of her doubts. And she even goes in to talk to Hawkeye after what he's done and talks about how she doesn't have anybody she can talk to about her doubts because she can't afford people to be questioning her.
Right. That's an interesting situation to put her in. It also, it speaks to the general nuance that I've seen throughout the Civil War, too. It's just very smartly written and conceived. And at no point is she just, like, basically running off half-cocked, like, oh, something bad's going to happen, we stop it.
Yeah.
It's not just that.
No,
there's much more going on.
This is very much the introspection of why? How does she do this? And it's the character exploring why she's in line with this. If you're just not buying it at all, like I wasn't with Civil War, the original one, you're going to have trouble plugging into it. But if you can acknowledge the heroes being on opposite sides of an ethical dilemma as a real thing, I think this is a really good read. And it's also, beyond that, just has some great action. It opens with this 3-panel shot of them solving 3 issues where the, she has the Ultimates with her one time, then the Avengers, and then sort of the younger Avengers like Spider-Man and
it's like a sort of a montage of stories.
And like one of them takes place in Simcaria, one of them is Manhattan, and just in these little bits of dialogue, there's like three stories told. And I was really impressed with the economy of storytelling there.
Nice.
And the little look at the larger Marvel universe. Dave, what you got for your backup pick?
My backup pick is a tie-in essentially with yours and continues my... I told a customer that when we were talking about Civil War with some of the HeroClix players on Civil War 2, some of the HeroClix players yesterday, that we were liking it.
Yeah.
And that it was like my pick last week or whatever. Yeah. And this is someone who listens to our podcast sometimes. So he knows of our Bendis antipathy, oftentimes Bendis antipathy.
Yep.
And he's like, what? He's like, you like, what?
Yeah.
Just like complete shock. And I was like, no. I mean, you know, we have to give credit where it's due. And it's been really well thought out. And so, indeed, my pick this week is going to be another Civil War II tie-in. This is a one-shot? Or no, it's a mini-series.
It's a two-issue, I think.
Okay. Just called... so it's Civil War II Ulysses.
Mm-hmm.
Ulysses is the sort of precog from the Inhumans who's been at the heart of the whole moral dilemma of it all, because he seems to see these disastrous events, and Captain Marvel wants to stop him. Iron Man is like, we need to be careful how we're doing this kind of weird future profiling thing,
mm-hmm.
and that there may be a little bit more to it than he's just having magical visions. Both sides have been given some good cases, but they have not zeroed in a ton on the kid himself.
Yeah,
he's like kind of a confused kid who's trying to figure out his powers. And is basically, even as his powers are shaping the future of Earth and all the superhumans and everything else, and in this issue, they give him somebody, they point him in the direction of somebody who's going to help him. And it's essentially the story of, and that person is Karnak, the Inhuman who's generally best known for his powers. He has the ability to spot the weakness in anything. So he could go up to a castle wall and like do this karate chop in just the perfect way and like bring down the whole wall. He's also like an amazing martial artist. And he's been getting revamped lately by Warren Ellis, and I haven't been closely following it, but it's Warren Ellis, and I know what to expect from him, and indeed, the character felt very Warren Ellis-y.
Yeah, he does.
In a kind of fun way, though.
Yeah.
So they take him to see him, and he is like this kind of cruel and weird sensei type.
Yeah.
Definitely turning him into that.
It really is like all about the, his first blush, Ulysses' first blush with a sensei who's going to mold him in ways that might be scary to him. Karnak is super intimidating.
Yeah.
There's a Medusa is actually, and a few other Inhumans are join him on the. Are they actually joining him at the training tower thing?
No. They all leave.
Yeah, they all leave and leave this poor kid to him. There's not a lot to say because plot wise, not a lot happens. It's really more about the tour of the strangeness that is Karnak's tower.
This is not a place I want to spend any time at all, by the way.
No, but it's fun to read about.
It is fun to read about.
There's a bunch of, like, there's weird Inhumans in there. Karnak himself is, like, this kind of Zen mystic, but, like, a cynical mystic.
Well, he's like, you remember, I mean, and this is a trope going back to 70s Kung Fu, but you remember the section of not Jackie Brown.
Kill Bill?
Kill Bill 2.
Yeah.
This is the cruel sensei.
Yes, he is definitely the cruel sensei. A cruel sensei who's got like this a power level that is on the superhuman level.
Yeah.
But
there's also like the weird cook, the inhuman cook, who's like this freakish looking guy who can't. He has no senses except taste, but the taste is so elevated that he can use it to see and that kind of thing.
Right.
There's some fun like inhuman power ideas in here.
Right.
This book had the effect of making me want to read both the Inhumans and Karnak.
Yeah, and that was, I think, what surprised me. Didn't Karnak say that, flavor is a distraction. He says, the gruel served here must have no trace of it. No trace of flavor.
No trace of flavor.
And so, I was amused at the idea of, you know, we've often seen the sensei who's like demands sort of a purity of spirit or something like that. And this extends even to the point of what they need to eat bland food and stuff so that nothing distracts. It's a fun story. It's honestly, I suppose, not so tied into the events of Civil War II, that it's like plot wise going to have a major effect.
Right.
And even, like I don't particularly care about Ulysses as a character, but what they've done is they've built a story that's interesting, and so I'm enjoying watching him kind of go through the ropes in this bizarre place. Anyway, I think it's be an easy one to pass up, sort of like The Fallen was last week, which was one of my picks last week.
Yeah.
The Fallen, which was the fallout to the death of the Hulk. And but I'm going to recommend this one. It is I think worth a read if you got a few extra bucks this week.
All right, Nick, take us back to DC.
I will take us back to DC, and I will take us back to Hellblazer, which is my secondary pick.
I think both you guys really liked the Rebirth special, didn't you?
I did.
And this is sort of just picking up the pieces where the last one left off, and it actually, in fact, goes with the flashback, tells you Swamp Thing's involvement in the previous. Plans of John Constantine coming back to England.
Okay.
And
I've noticed
how
that some
he
of the DC
them.
Ones, sometimes the Rebirth special is standalone, and sometimes, somewhat to my frustration...
It's basically an issue one,
yeah. And you needed to understand it. So I'm happy to hear that this kind of recaps some of that.
It does recap some of that. It brings to light some things we didn't know about it.
That's nice art. Just real quick, who's the
artist? I mean, it's Moritat. So it's gorgeous. Yeah. The guy who did Elephant Man. And...
Right, and for people who don't know, this is a guy who's kind of got a European style that will... I mean, you know, not to be too free in evoking the legends, but has something in common with Mobius and who's the other guy?
It's actually Morbius, the living vampire.
Belial, Inky Belial, and those kind of elaborate European artists.
And it's Belial. He's a demon.
All right, nobody's talking to you.
But Moritat's take on Swamp Thing looks fantastic.
It does.
And this is just a fun little story of basically these two... I don't want to call them friends, but they're friendly with each other.
You mean
Constantine and Swamp Thing.
They're compadres.
They're compadres.
They're contemporaries.
That Constantine does bring up the whole, you took over my body to use as a, basically have sex with your wife.
So they are keeping that in continuity. That Swamp Thing has had kids. Yeah, basically Constantine was his... surrogate with Abby Cable.
Yeah.
Because when Swamp Thing comes up, he's like, do you need me to be your sex stand-in again? But no, the big deal about this is Swamp Thing is coming to Constantine for aid. Abby has completely fallen off of the world, face of the map. Basically, he can't find her anywhere.
And Constantine, if nothing else, he knows people.
Yeah.
He does know people, so Swamp Thing enlists his help. And, of course, it goes from there. Some new villains are... teased at the beginning and end. And I don't know, it feels very much in line with what Vertigo was doing.
I mean,
there are the squares, I mean, they're blanked out, but you can definitely fill in the blanks really easily. And it feels like the bastard that Constantine, should be.
Oh, okay.
So I'm very pleased with what Simon Oliver's doing.
Nick, does it still feel to you somewhat like a somewhat younger Constantine? Like where the... You know, the Vertigo one was a guy who was, I would say, 40 or within a few years of it.
I feel like he's like 30. He may be a little bit younger, but you can still see that he's well-traveled. He feels like he's been through the ringer, like, a billion times.
Right.
And he definitely has some troubles. Right.
Constantine is definitely a guy who's probably old before his time.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't feel like that's lost.
But I did feel like the sense, actually, and I actually considered a quality of the book and not like they missed a step from the old stuff, is that there is maybe a little bit more youthful energy. It might have just been because he seemed hornier. he's just a little bit more on the prowl for somebody to share his bed than I think Constantine, who of the Vertigo era, who had a few girls who could kind of catch his eye, but it was pretty rare, and when he fell for somebody, it seemed like he kind of fell hard. This is casual sex, John Constantine. Yeah. Yes.
Most of the time in the Vertigo stuff, he was kind of solitary in a lot of ways.
Correct. Yeah, I think he'd had bad experiences and probably killed off some girlfriends.
Probably.
Probably so.
This one, by contrast, is all like, oh, behave.
So you're comparing this to the John Constantine by way of Austin Powers?
By the way, that's the second Austin Powers reference this podcast.
it's day. Yeah, no, by no means is he sex-starved. I actually appreciate, that's one thing that I liked, is that he was a little bit more youthful and a little bit more passionate and not quite as much a total burnout as he became in the Vertigo line.
Sure. Nick, what else you got?
All right, so I've got a few more DC on my list. So I've got the first issue of Deathstroke, which again harkens back to the Rebirth special and basically is a continuation. I really enjoyed it. I find the, especially the relationship between Deathstroke and Wintergreen, probably one of the best things priests bring to the table.
Which they are sort of reinventing, right?
A little bit, but they've always been sort of friends and
We haven't seen them as compatriots at war. That's always been implied. We haven't really seen them in right. battle together. So, again, the youthening of the DC Universe, to some extent, seems to be going on there.
Yep. The second issue of Batgirl, which continues Batgirl's training throughout different lands.
Really this, nice art.
Yeah, this is Rafael Albuquerque doing an amazing job. Has Barbara doing some MMA, it looks like.
Yep. And sort of doing subplot stuff with her her kind of boyfriend slash childhood friend or like school friend, I guess.
School friend and sort of this blossoming romance a little bit. Yes. Just, and I liked seeing that side of Barbara. You know, sometimes she comes across as being very hard.
Yeah.
And sort of I seeing think, that kind of, you know, softening to a
I
person
think the
Babs
Tarr era, I think, opened her up to a little bit more on the relationship side.
Then I've got the second issue of Titans, which sees Abracadabra, an old Wally West villain, come back and kind of cause some chaos. Then the issue 939 of Detective Comics. You know,
we all like that.
Yeah,
book.
I think this is still one of our favorites of, out of all of DC Rebirth. This, of course, has some great moments.
It's funny to me that the Batverse has, once again, sort of staked out the territory of the best stuff, where I like, for me, my favorites right now, if I had to pick them, would be All-Star Batman and Robin. We'll see if it continues after. That was just based on the first
And
issue.
I have to say,
James
Tynion here, I have never seen this opening scene with a young Bruce. I've never seen this moment
idea.
Before.
Yeah, that was a good idea.
And I feel like it was a very strong moment for all the characters.
I agree.
A good way to tie in a character who is new enough in conception that you don't think of them as being part of his life as a kid.
Right, and also I think Tynion has brought to the table pieces of Batman I've never seen before in that relationship with Kathy Kane.
Right.
Or Kate Kane, or I always confuse those, but the relationship he has with her is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The 962 of Action Comics, which actually does see the wrap up of the Doomsday storyline.
Yep.
I actually thought it was a good ending.
Good.
Then I've got Blue Beetle number 1. Which, like Randy said,
we've talked about it. We've had it signed already.
Yes.
A great time was had.
But we haven't mentioned Scott Collins does the interior art, which is great.
I have to say, this feels a little like Scott Collins when he was doing The Flash.
It's really good.
It's
and
fantastic.
It also matches up a sort of mentor version of Ted Kord with a little more of a reluctant hero, Jaime Reyes. And I love the design for Ted Kord as a mentor. He's got the goggles. But he's not in a full-on costume.
Yeah, it's like he's wearing a Blue Beetle like a T-shirt with his logo on.
And
that's cool.
And the bug is back, and they're using it as their Batcave. It's a good first issue.
And one of the things I was really curious to see is how important Jaime Reyes' family will be involved.
Yeah.
And it seems like they're definitely bringing that back.
Yeah, and I'm glad.
And I think the father and mother and the sister are all fantastic characters.
Agreed.
And then I just have a couple more. So Kingsway West number 1, the new Greg Pak, Miracle Kolek, sort of kind of Old West meets magic and dragons.
Yes, it's an alternate timeline where like magic got introduced and created sort of notably different sort of I don't quite know how to put it, but like racial factions.
Yeah, well, there's like a Chinese Empire on in California.
Yep.
And it's a different West, but with magic. So,
and then there's the second issue of Sombra, which is sort of like Boom's version of the Punisher in Mexican cartels.
Yep.
It was very interesting. The second issue of Rom.
Yep.
Which does start the whole revolution, which is the cross pollination of Transformers, Mask,
G.I. Joe,
and everything. And then the start of a new miniseries, which I did read and actually thought was fantastic. Six Pack and Dog Welder from Section 8. Some crazy stuff that I...
For people who don't know, and that should be everybody probably, unless you happen to have read Hitman from DC's 90s thing, this is a spin-off of the super oddball heroes, almost Tick-level weird guys, but like as filtered through sort of Garth Ennis's twisted sense of humor.
Yes.
These were some of the heroes that Tommy knew back in the Hitman.
Yeah, but focusing on people like, Dog Welder and
whose
Bator.
Powers to weld dog to things.
But there's a little bit more to him in this one. They brought a little bit more to the table to everyone. I will you also
see the multiple facets of Dog Welder.
I yeah. also will say that Bueno Excelente has a romantic relationship with an actual relationship with somebody.
Well, that's disturbing.
It's a little okay. disturbing, and especially
this is, by the way, a hero who fights crime with the powers of perversion.
Yep.
And also, you get to see Catwoman smack Beator's ass.
Okay.
But also, Catwoman and Starfire and Power Girl make an appearance.
Okay.
It was a really fun first issue.
Dave, what else you got?
Let's see. There's the fourth issue of the D&D comic, Shadows of the Vampire. And not to spoil anything, but I saw that Strahd makes a notable appearance nice. In this. Let's see. On the DC side, Nick, did you mention there's a new Wonder Woman?
I did not.
New Wonder Woman out. Let's see. Wacky Raceland has its third issue, Archie number 11. Let's see. Oh, and I did want to also mention Matt Frank's new Godzilla comic,
oh, yeah.
Which I haven't had a chance to read yet, but this is like a Godzilla with time travel elements. It looks like it's feudal Japan going on, because I see actual samurai and stuff like that. And I don't know if it's strictly speaking in that era, or if they're going to be bouncing around in time. But flipping through, and I see not just Godzilla, but multiple monsters thrown down in ancient Japan. So definitely, Godzilla fans, check this one out. And then lastly, I was going to mention a collected edition. The Marvel does this thing called the Epic Collection, which is sort of best of sort of sequences from their various comics. This is a Defenders volume called The Six-Fingered Hand. And for me, it's a particular spark of nostalgia because one of the first comics I got as a kid was the 100th issue of Defenders. It was like a giant-sized issue in which the Defenders, the weirdest superhero team ever, goes to hell. They're in hell. They're put through these various doomsday scenarios by the devil. It was weird and yet emotional. And, you know, like, I was compelled by, like, sort of the human elements. And yet this is a comic that has Doctor Strange, Silver Surfer, the powerhouses and the Hulk and stuff like that. The powerhouses of the Marvel Universe. And also weird characters like Devil Slayer, the Vietnam vet who fights demonic powers.
And Valkyrie.
And Valkyrie and Gargoyle, the World War I vet, who's a twisted little gargoyle man.
Yep.
Anyway, I am planning to pick this up because the one thing, although that 100th issue was satisfying in its own right, it was clearly me stepping into a story that was already in full effect and begun prior to that. And I also remember very dramatically the issue following it, which is sort of a character downtime issue, which the Defenders must renew. Among other things, features a sequence in which Devil Slayer, who has this kind of very brash superhero-y costume, but most people can't see it unless they're demons, is seen by this burned-out hippie dude playing guitar on the street begging for change. He sees through it, and the guy is like, you know, demon, what have, you know, how can you see me? Only I believe the demon is drug addiction. I believe J.M. Demetis, this is like quintessential 70s, early 80s Marvel Defender stuff, which is to say it's very trippy. It's got counterculture elements blending with very classic superhero elements and tales of redemption. But it's also like got these kind of melancholy and sad stories, and it's a weird and interesting merging point of all of that stuff. So I'm going to recommend Defender's Six-Fingered Hand for people looking for some weird Marvel, and I will definitely be revisiting it myself.
All right. I've got, Nighthawk number 4, which is a great book. Unfortunately, nobody's reading this book, but it is, urban vigilantism in Chicago. It is David Walker who's doing that great Power Man Iron Fist run. It's got really beautiful art by Ramon Villalobos.
We were talking about this earlier, Randy, and I was saying how much I'm enjoying, and now that I've gotten into reading Power Man and Iron Fist, that there was this amazing character scene last week that was just kind of a casual scene where a conversation between Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, which is like a husband and wife conversation that was really strong and insightful for both characters, and you were and I was like just talking about how casually great it was, and you were saying that same kind of knowledge of character and depth was brought to bear on Nighthawk, and I'm like, okay, I need to read it.
David Walker is one of the best writers working at Marvel right now, and I feel like this is going to be one of those underrated gems people will read later and go, oh, I wish I'd read that. Mm-hmm. So you could be one of those hipster guys be like, oh, I read it. It was great. Too bad you weren't reading it and it got canceled.
Yeah. And then you flick your beret at them.
Steve Rogers, Captain America number 4, continues the weird Captain America is part of Hydra thing. We're definitely deep into the weeds on this story. I'm like, I'm not sure where they're going, but there's a lot of interesting stuff. And if you're liking what he's doing on Sam Wilson, which I really am, this is an interesting flip side to it. Snot Girl number 2, which is more of Brian Lee O'Malley's weird fashion blogger. Turned into maybe there was like a murder in there or an accident, but this is more of that sort of character interaction stuff. The weird thing for me, this is like a mix between like Scott Pilgrim and Chew, because the fashion aspect and how fashion sort of feeds into everything reminds me of how like food powers relate to everything in Chew. And it is weird. It's not as weird as Chew, but this is a strange book that I'm really enjoying. The Valiant Universe Handbook is this week. We talked about how Faith and Generation Zero are definitely sort of a gateway into it that you don't actually need to get into the universe. But if you do want to, this is a really cool-looking Marvel Universe-style book. It's, like, alphabetical.
Polished encyclopedia.
There's some nice art. There's write-ups of all the different characters that will give you a sense of who all these people are. And it's just – it's a great little book. I like it. Star Wars 22, which has a new artist, Jorge Molina – who I really like on this. It's almost a more cartoony style, but it really works. And it sees a sort of a desperate mission where they're going in to try and take over a Star Destroyer to use for some kind of rebel plan. It's a really fun issue. And finally, Voltron Legendary Defender number 2 has everything I liked about the Voltron cartoon. It's great comedy, fun little bits of character, and then a big fight between Voltron and a giant beast. And
I only just started reading it, but the opening sequence was great.
The way they defeat the beast is particularly clever and fun, and sort of harkens back to one of the characters a little bit. It's really good. If you like the cartoon, and you should have, because it was great, you should definitely give a shot to this comic, because it is the same people writing it, and it feels like sort of a lost episode. All right, that wraps up our comics talk for the week. We'll be back in just a second to talk about some TV and movies and games and other stuff. All right, welcome to the Nick was right portion of our podcast, where Nick can yell at me for not listening to him in the first place. But I did. It just took me a while to get to it.
Yeah.
So a couple things that I started watching. While I was on vacation, I watched a movie, Straight Outta Compton, which actually I believe Dave was the one who recommended that one to me. And Straight Outta Compton, I am not a biopic guy by any means, but I love Straight Outta Compton.
Right, which is a biopic of the early days
of NWA.
NWA, so you're going to see Dr. Dre, Ice Cube, Eazy-E. And I feel like I'm missing somebody.
And Paul Giamatti's white character.
Yes.
Snoop Dogg is in there.
Snoop Dogg is in there.
But Paul Giamatti is amazing in everything.
Oh, he's great.
But the rest of the cast is up to the task.
But that's nice. A little flow there.
I have sick flow at the drop of a hat.
But this sort of taught me some stuff about early hip hop and rap that I didn't really know. I sort of knew this from the periphery from growing up in the 80s and 90s. But I didn't follow these guys, and so a lot of the music and stuff was stuff I had not heard growing up, and the history of it is sort of I had seen from the outside but hadn't really seen how it all stuck together, and like stuff like seeing Suge Knight and his awfulness.
Yes.
He always
seemed like a legitimate, like, horrible gangster, violent and terrible.
Yeah. But it was really good, and I really liked it, and I was very happy with it. The music's great, so
yeah.
All the performances, all the actors that they got, fantastic.
Yeah,
I believe we were talking about this the other day, Nick, and you were talking about how the amazing resemblance between the actor they got to play Ice Cube and Ice Cube.
Yes,
which I had learned. I only found this out after the fact. Is Ice Cube's son?
Yeah, that might be why the resemblance is so strong.
Yeah, yep. But to his credit, he is not just – it doesn't come across as like some guy just doing an imitation.
No.
Or coasting on the visual likeness. He legitimately pulls it off.
Yeah, he's really good.
So the son plays the father. It was a little
– it is a little weird.
Then I also watched the movie Dope,
yep,
which I know you recommended to me. And it is – It's basically sort of a – someone described it as sort of risky business in Compton.
They're not wrong.
It's not in Compton, though. It's in –
No, it's – I forget where it takes place.
Oh, man, it's in California. It's in Southern California. But it's basically this guy. There's sort of three nerds. Two of them are guys. One of them is a girl who's a lesbian. And they're nerds in that they listen. They're all about the '90s hip hop and the '90s culture, and it's modern day. But they're all night. They've got flat tops and all that kind of stuff.
So they're trying to get into college.
And they're trying to get into college. They run afoul of sort of the dope enterprise that is big in their neighborhood, and they get invited to a party. And when they go, something happens to sort of put them into this world. And from there, it's not wacky, but it is sort of hijinks. They're just trying to get this thing done. And they've got thugs looking out for the drugs that they're after. Yeah. And, they're just trying to sort of survive this thing. And at the same time, there's a little bit of sex comedy in there. Mm-hmm. And it was really, really good. And I loved what they did with these characters. It's funny. It's clever. It's just smart. Yeah. It's a great movie.
I think I'm going to prioritize seeing that. It sounds really good.
It's really good. It's on Netflix.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah, it's also on Netflix, and right in line with the two things is The Get Down, which is Baz Luhrmann's
I haven't had a chance
early
to watch
days
this,
of but... 70s-era hip-hop.
Yeah, sort of the bridge between disco and hip-hop, and Grandmaster Flash is a character, and all these other hip-hop icons are in there, and it is about a small crew called the Get Down Crew that is basically trying to learn the art of DJing and try to stay away from – one of them is involved in sort of the disco club and the drug running there. One of them is sort of an orphan because of his parents got shot in like a drive-by. Uh-huh. And there's also this girl who wants to be a singer. Her dad owns this mega church and she wants to be a disco singer. And Jimmy Smits plays this councilman who is trying to rejuvenate the South Bronx – for the Puerto Rican population. And all this stuff comes together in Baz Luhrmann's sort of huge, lots of music, very big and almost musical style.
Right.
But I really dug this. Some people are going to hate this. but if you have any fondness for Baz Luhrmann at all or an interest in early 70s hip hop, this was really good and
I
liked it.
I'm really interested in checking this out mainly because I love Baz Luhrmann, but I know my wife just can't get past the sort of synopsis of sort of that early 70s hip hop. She's just not interested.
Yeah.
So I'm just trying to get her to watch it, and I don't.
It may not be her thing. I mean, it's not going to be for everybody, I think.
Play her Grandmaster Flash is the message.
Yeah.
And you tell her this is the secret origin of it.
But if I've heard correctly, this is Netflix's biggest budgeted show, isn't it?
This has been in the works for like 2 years, and there's been a bit of a troubled production. And
Beth Lerman's stuff does tend toward visually fantastical.
Oh, yeah. I mean, Moulin Rouge.
Yeah. And finally, the show that Nick recommended to me a while back that I finally got on, which is Crazy Ex-Girlfriend on the CW. The first season showed up on Netflix. It's Rachel Bloom, who I had not realized was the same person who did that Fuck Me Ray Bradbury video, which is hilarious and fun. And I also didn't know, and I swear you didn't tell me this, that it was a musical show.
Oh, I mentioned the music.
Did you? Because every episode is original music and like set pieces and all that kind of stuff. And
so sort of like a Flight of the Conchords esque or something?
No, because that's actually like this is more like in her dream world.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it's Flight of the Conchords is surreal too. They just randomly break out into song all over the place.
Yeah.
And this is sort of, you know, her inner psyche at work.
Yeah, it's
you know,
what's it about?
So she is a high powered lawyer in New York. A little neurotic, and she's kind of feeling down. She runs into her boyfriend from summer camp, who they dated for like 2 months when they were 16. And he sort of, you know, he sort of playfully is like, "Oh, you turned out you're beautiful, and you got this great job." He's like, "I really missed the boat, huh?" And he tells her about how he's moving from New York to this sort of smaller part of Southern California. And she turns down a big promotion and moves out to California. And sort of she keeps saying like, "I didn't come here for Josh. He just happens to be here. I came for a change." But it's obviously that basically she had a chance encounter with an old boyfriend and upended her entire life to move out to this small town in California to basically try and get with this boyfriend.
Well, it was sort of the relationship that she kind of coined the term relationship for her. It was the best experience she had.
Right.
And she's unhappy. and sort of New York has kind of trodden, you know, her psyche and everything down. So.
She's sort of chasing this teenage relationship and trying to make mm-hmm. it part of her. And yeah, she gets a bunch of friends out there, and she so it goes between like her working at the law office, her trying to sort of win over her boy Josh, her ex boyfriend. And
she finds this kinship with her coworker.
Her coworker, who I love, who's named Paula, and yeah, it's a really fun show that has great musical bits every episode. And I wasn't sure I was going to love this as much as I did, but I am completely in love with it.
What was one of the musical bits?
The opening sequence is a musical bit where it's called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend,
yeah.
where it's her describing her how she left. And then her supporting cast shows up in cartoon form and starts singing how she's the crazy ex-girlfriend. And she's like, well, it's more nuanced than that. And they just kind of keep repeating crazy ex-girlfriend.
Nice.
It's a funny bit. And there's a second episode has one that is her getting ready for a date that is sort of takes aim at sort of everything that women have to do to put on this fake beauty to go out and,
right.
and date, and shows guy's preparation is basically taking a nap. And yeah. it's hilarious.
Yeah, that sounds about right. That's great.
It's really fun. I'm really digging it. Dave, you have been playing new video games.
Yeah, I've been playing as always off the beaten path stuff. Not in a hipster way, but in a I just stumble into weird shit way. let's see. Let's start with the more notable of the two, which was a fairly notable indie release for a game called Abzu. That is A-B-Z-U with that little sort of umlauty thing over the U.
Gesundheit.
And it's from the guys who made the very well-received game Journey, which I know a lot of my friends have played and really enjoyed. It was a downloadable game for like about $20 or better on sale oftentimes. That was kind of a fantasy exploration game with a sort of low stakes. There were some eerie and dangerous, sort of menacing parts of it, but by and large it was kind of a tranquil game with a very emotional and sort of spiritual storyline. I wouldn't necessarily think that that's my thing, but as it turns out, these guys made not only had very fun gameplay that was sort of a more relaxed game, but a story that intrigued me a lot and got me emotionally involved. And so their new game from some of those same people is called Abzu, and does something similar but with underwater exploration.
Okay.
Where Journey was sort of these desert landscapes and caves and things like that, and eventually a icy mountaintop. This one has you as like a diver, and it's kind of surreal in the sense that it's not telling you who you are, where you came from. In fact, even like Journey, the gender is somewhat ambiguous on your diver, so the person is very easy to kind of find as an avatar for whoever is playing it. But you can move in sort of full 360 degrees, and you go around and you swim and you explore, and there is cool animal life everywhere down there that is based on real fish, but kind of stylized versions. They use some of the same motion development they developed in Journey to make these amazing schools of fishes that will track you and will follow you. This is a game where there is a button to ride animals. So when there's like a giant sea turtle or something nearby to you, you can press that and you kind of climb gently onto them, and you can control them with the same controls you use for yourself. Occasionally, if you try it with something like, say, a shark,
mm-hmm.
they'll try and throw you off. They're not wild about it. But again, it's a kind of quieter game that does still have this kind of mysticism that Journey did, though. As you explore around, a story does begin to take shape. You do find some things that are somewhat threatening down there, and there's one sequence that made me jump more than probably any other game has in the last few years. Precisely because the game had been so relaxed prior mm-hmm. to this. But you'll find little small probes and things to activate. You do kind of have to figure out small riddles, not riddles, but like clues and things to move on to new areas, which will provide you with sort of, they'll move this plot forward. There's these sort of hieroglyphics and things you'll find in caves that sort of suggest like an Atlantean culture or something like that. There's sort of some sunken ruins. And progressively larger sea life, to the point where yes, you're gonna see these giant whales and stuff like that. Mm. And by the time you encounter them, it is an amazing experience. And they make a point of making it even more so than you might think. And it does build to it's another short game. I feel like probably like 4 or 5 hours of gameplay, and you know, you will get to the end of the story. But it's a game that I'm already, just like Journey, I'm wanting to go back and play again, just to look around. I know that there are sort of secrets that I haven't discovered, and it's just cool to do. You can the raw and, you know, mechanics of swimming around, which you can move pretty quickly, so it's not just slow pacing through there, is really cool. So, I don't know. I'm recommending it to all the Journey people and anybody who likes the idea of undersea exploration stuff.
And then you also had an app game that you've been playing.
An app game I've been playing. I never played the old, was it Mafia or Mafia Wars? What was that game?
Yeah, Mafia Wars on Facebook.
That was like such a big thing at the time. I gather this is like the Batman version of that, because it's called Arkham Underworld. And it's about creating a criminal empire in Arkham, in Gotham City.
Mm-hmm.
You start out as a lowly guy in like their sort of slum district. You've got a headquarters that you kind of outfit and can be raided by other players. And you start building up your muscle and your teams. You go out and you rob banks, knock over other criminals, take down dirty cops that won't accept your payoffs. Actually, yeah, it's like there's not a lot of cop killing in it. But occasionally there is, usually because they're bad guys, but they won't take your bribes.
Okay.
and when it goes to those sequences in the game, it's sort of a isometric view, not unlike something like Diablo.
Okay.
You kind of point and click where you go, and you will immediately start with a escaped Riddler, who's cooler than you would think. He's actually relatively tough. He's got a double-barreled shotgun that he'll unload on people with, and
the Riddler does.
And his cane, which can. Oh, by the way, this uses the visual style of the Arkham games. Like, I believe it uses for the cutscenes, which are mostly more like almost like motion comics. They don't use full-on animation, but it's all the visuals from the Arkham, the full Arkham games.
Okay,
so Croc looks like Killer Croc in those. Mr. Freeze looks like Mr. Freeze in those. They have really nice design work on this, and for a free app, it's actually pretty slick looking, I gotta say. I did one micropayment at one point for their early one that budgets you a bunch of diamonds, which is there's two actually I guess there's three different currencies in it. There's just cash, there's reputation, and I forget what the diamonds are. Anyway, nice. You can use them to speed stuff up. It's because it is one of those games. I don't normally like those games, but because this one was so easy to get into, and because it's got all this cool Batman themed stuff, it's actually a lot of fun to play. You know, you're going up against like Falcone's mob boys. You're bringing in Harley Quinn. You're doing missions that the Suicide Squad comes after Harley Quinn at one point. And so you've occasionally got missions where Amanda Waller sends in, like Argus soldiers to try and recapture her. And, you know, Deadshot will, like, be like, I've got your back, and he'll take out some of the bad guys for you. And, you know, you and your guys have to try and complete the regular mission. But I gotta say, it's been super fun. I've been playing it kind of addictively each night for a couple weeks now. Decent level. Still getting my place raided. It can only get raided when you're not playing. So you set up guards, sandbags. You choose which villain is guarding it, because only one can guard it at a time. Right now I got Mr. Freeze, Harley, Riddler, and Killer Croc. I know at least Scarecrow and Bane are also available, and I'm sure they'll add more later on. But, you know, you choose which one is right for the mission. As you know, if you know you're going to be going through a lot of heavy muscle, you're going to want Croc, who can take the punishment. Riddler is awesome at taking out electronic devices and auto turrets and stuff. Harley Quinn is fast and dodgy for weapons, and she throws down like a little jack-in-the-box with a machine gun in it that will take out guys. Anyway, it's, you know, if any of this stuff interests, it's a free-to-play thing. Yes, there's micropayments, but, you know, you don't have to pay them to get into any of that stuff just to try it out.
We live in the world of micropayments.
We do.
Nick, surprisingly no one, you have discovered a new podcast.
I have, as I try to find as many as I can. No, but this is called Ars Paradoxica, and I just want to read the sort of synopsis because I think it's actually a really good one, better than I can put into words. And it says, this is a love letter to physics, fiction, and the future. It is a disorienting journey through the space-time and the Cold War. It's a tome of secret history you stumbled across in the library in the dead of night. Basically, It's when an experiment in time, much like our own, goes horribly awry, Dr. Sally Grissom finds herself stranded in the past and entrenched in the activities of a clandestine branch of the U.S. government. Grissom and her team quickly learn that there's no safety net when toying with the fundamental logic of the universe. And this actually just really deals with time travel, Cold War, Manhattan Projects, sort of things like that. But it's got a great sense of character. Yeah. And I feel like the voice actors are top-notch. Mm-hmm. And sort of, it feels like there's a lot of time and money spent into doing it, because I feel like all the... It just feels very crisp and clean. And there's a great sense of sort of using, like...
Is it... Now, I asked you this earlier, but I forget what the answer was. Like, is it an audio play in the sense that there's, like... Is there sound effects and stuff? Or is it more like recordings?
It's more like recordings, and they'll use, like, sort of fade in, fade out. Like, she's using...
Like you're walking in on a conversation?
That, but she's also using 1940s technology to sort of record her reports in a lot of ways. Yeah. So it kind of fizzles in and out because it's not right. sort of
they
a tried
They
true.
Have those old dictaphones.
Yes, and... But it's sort of just... Her kind of not wanting to screw with history and tell people things, but also that's inevitably going to happen and sort of the causality of that.
Is she from our present?
She's in a present sort of like our own. So she's from maybe this or a little bit in the future. So
okay.
It's just a fun podcast. And I don't think the first season is completed, but yeah.
So it's a good time too, for people could get in and get, you know, be... Sharing the finale with everybody else.
Yeah, I have listened to three of them, and they're all just fantastic. Huh. So I'm very excited about this one. I've got a few more that I'm going to try out, but this is one I've really, really enjoyed.
All right. That wraps it up for us this week. We'll be back with more next week, and until that time...
Yo, Joe!
Thanks for listening. If you like the show, do us a favor and spread the word to your friends. Or give us a quick 5-star rating or review on iTunes to help us grow our audience. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or at www.roguesgallerytx.com. We'll be back next week.